This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
This will be our third pair of messages on the character of Saul, and eventually we'll be contrasting his character with that of David. Obviously, David is not in the picture yet in our studies, so this will be parts 5 and 6 of the series, and I've titled this pair of messages, Saul Chokes on Agag. Last time, we were looking at three major events in the early career of Saul's kingship, which demonstrated his failure to be the kind of leader who would please God and be a leader who would be a blessing to his people. In chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, if you want to be turning to 1 Samuel 13 or 14, in 1 Samuel 13, we saw he made his first big mistake, and that was when Saul did not wait on Samuel to offer the sacrifice. And remember how he blamed it on the people. And he said, "Gee, Samuel, the people were just getting antsy, and I had to do something. You know, the Philistines were possibly going to attack us, and you weren't here, and gosh, I just thought I had to do something, so I didn't wait for you. I killed the sacrifice." So he blamed it on the people. Then in chapter 14, we read about his second major mistake. Saul made a very foolish vow, which would have resulted in the death of his very own son, Jonathan, had it not been for the people protesting and basically saving the life of Jonathan. Now we're ready to pick up where we left off, which is in verse 47 of chapter 14. And soon we will come to the third major failure in Saul's early career. So 1 Samuel 14, verse 47. "So Saul took the kingdom over Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab and against the children of Ammon and against Edom and against the kings of Zobah and against the Philistines. And whithersoever he turned himself, he vexed them." Most of us are probably familiar with who these enemies of Israel listed here, who they are. The Moabites and the Ammonites were Semites, of course. They were descendants of Abraham's nephew Lot, through incest with his daughters. The Edomites were descendants of Jacob, Israel's brother Esau. But remember that Esau married 5 wives, 4 of whom were Canaanites, 3 were Hittites and 1 was a Hivite, and then the 5th wife was an Ishmaelite. Now the Philistines were actually not Semites, they were Hamites, descendants of Mizraim. Ham's son Mizraim. Mizraim was one of the 4 sons of Ham, and Mizraim was the ancient name for Egypt. And some of these Mizraimites, or Egyptians, came and settled on the coasts of Canaan land. And when they did, they were then called Philistines. Does anybody know what the word Philistine means? Immigrants. Do we have some Philistines down in the southwestern border of the United States? Or really all the borders of the United States? Okay. Philistines all over, right? Now Canaan, as you know, was another of the 4 sons of Ham. And by the way, if you remember the curse that Noah uttered regarding Ham, it was not a curse on Ham himself, was it? It was on Ham's son Canaan and his descendants. But in this verse, who are the kings of Zobah? I'd never heard of them. Well, reference books tell us this was a relatively small Aramean kingdom, which most scholars believe was situated between Damascus and the Euphrates River. It comes more into play during the reign of King David. Notice that it says in the first line of verse 47 that Saul took the kingdom. Well, I thought he'd already been anointed king and all of that. Well, that's true. But what this means is that even though he had been ceremonially installed, publicly installed as king, that he really did not establish his authority as king until he had done some of these military campaigns. It's cynical attitude, perhaps, but nonetheless it's true, and all politicians know it. There's nothing like a good war to unite the people into a nation, right? And Saul was only doing what was expected of kings. He was to gather the men and lead them in battle against their enemies. That's exactly what he did, and it helped to establish his kingship over the people. Notice also it says at the end of that verse that Saul vexed his enemies. This means that he harassed them as opposed to subduing them once and for all. The fact is, Saul had some victories, but they were sporadic and temporary. It would take King David to make them permanent. And we can see the spiritual analogy in this. Saul, representing corporately the church in the age of Pentecost, Saul is insufficient to bring in the glorious kingdom age. Saul also represents each believer while in the Pentecostal realm. And I'm not talking about Pentecostal / charismatic circles. I'm talking about all believers in the age of Pentecost, which has been from the day of Pentecost in Acts 2 and until relatively recently. So we are all in a Pentecostal realm at some point in our walk, because it's beyond the basics of first level salvation. It's when the believer has entered into the holy place, if we're looking at it from the tabernacle's analogy. But it's still a realm of insufficiency. It's constant spiritual warfare. It's battling the Philistines, spiritually battling the flesh. There are some great victories, but there are always more battles to wage. It's never a permanent rest. That rest, the permanent rest, is for the age of tabernacles, when the people of God come into his rest, as it says in the book of Hebrews. Verse 48, "And he gathered an host and smote the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of them that spoiled them." This reference to the battle with the Amalekites is probably a preview, or actually a summary of the story that we're about to encounter, so we'll pass over it for now. Next, we find some genealogical data on King Saul. It says, "Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishui and Melchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these, the name of the firstborn Merab, and the name of the younger Michal." Some of you might be aware that Saul had other sons, and we might wonder, why aren't they listed here? Well, it's possible that the only sons listed here are the ones who went into these battles named here in these verses. And or these are the same three sons who are later listed as the sons killed with Saul in the final battle with the Philistines. It is sometimes confusing for Bible readers to keep genealogies straight because some people are called by two or more different names. For example, here's a son named Ishui, who is also known as Abinadab. Now, sometimes there's a similarity between names of the same person, and sometimes there's no resemblance whatsoever. For example, we all know this example. Who's the father-in-law of Moses? Don't we? Jethro. Thank you, Martha. Do you know he had another name? Anybody know the other name? Yes, Reuel. R-E-U-E-L. And a third one, Raguel. I mean, you can see the similarity between Raguel and Reuel, but between Jethro and Reuel, no resemblance whatsoever, but the same guy. For those of us who understand the Israel message, this concept of name changes is well known. We have studied how the tribes of Israel lost their identities as they migrated across Europe and Asia, or Asia and Europe, over the centuries. Sometimes the similarities in names can be seen as it goes from one language to another, such as the chain of names by which we trace the sons of Isaac, and it eventually becomes the Sac sons, or the Saxons. I mean, that's a gimme. And yet, with other names of the branches of the Israel people, their names were completely obliterated and lost through the various languages over the centuries. Now, there have been books written about this topic, which I'm sure many of us are aware of. One which comes to mind immediately is called the Post-Captivity Names of Israel, written back in the 30s, I think, by a British minister, Reverend William Pascoe Gord, G-O-A-R-D. Anybody familiar with that book? There's one much more recent that discusses the same idea, written by our good friend, Bible archaeologist E. Raymond Capt. It's his book. In fact, he discusses it in many of his books, but the one that we carry is Missing Links Discovered in the Assyrian Tablets. We carry that book in stock. Now, verse 50 says, the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz, and the name of the captain of his host was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Today we would say that Abner was Saul's general of the armies, or in peculiarly American terminology, we would call him the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner the father of Abner was, the son of Abiel. And there was sore war, or fierce war, against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him unto him. You see, Saul, being a type of Pentecost, was never able to totally subdue the Philistines. We know that Saul reigned for 40 years, and so some think that these last several verses we've just looked at, which are listing all the enemies of Saul, that this was kind of a summary of his reign in advance of the whole story. Surely Saul had indeed become not just a strong man in Israel, but he became a tyrant very early on. That's what we're seeing as we do these studies. But just this last verse here, number 52, tells us that he had the power to compel any man to, quote, volunteer, unquote, for his army. Sound familiar? Saul was, in fact, fulfilling exactly what God had told Moses and what Samuel had reiterated for the people when they were demanding a king. Remember the prophecy and Samuel's reiteration of it? He says, oh, okay, folks, you want a king like all the other nations? You're going to get him. But this is what he's going to do. He's going to take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers, and he's going to take your sons and appoint them over his chariots and horsemen and so forth. In other words, he's going to draft all your boys into the army. Now we come to setting the stage for Saul's big test. We can assume that for some time Saul had been pretty much left to his own devices and his talents as he consolidated the kingdom under his own authority, but now the time had come for the test. 1 Samuel 15, verse 1. Samuel also said unto Saul, Yahweh, or the Lord, sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore hearken thou unto the voice of the words of Yahweh. As this scene opens, we really have no indication of exactly when in the reign of Saul this occurred, but it seems that Samuel is reminding him that, look, Saul, you are only the king because Yahweh chose you. Therefore, you owe him your total service and obedience. So listen carefully now and see if you can enter again into God's good graces by following and obeying his commands exactly. Then Samuel continues, verse 2, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy. I want you to notice that phrase. We'll come back to it later. Utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. Okay, who were these Amalekites, and why were they slated for complete annihilation? Well, Amalek was the grandson of Esau, and his descendants, the Amalekites, some say Amalekites, they were a very fierce and cruel nomadic people who lived in the wilderness south of the land of Judah, all the way down the Arabian coast on the Saudi Arabia side, down almost to modern-day Yemen. Turn to Genesis 36. Let's take a little detour here. Verse 12, Genesis 36, verse 12, where it says, and Timnah was concubine to Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bare to Eliphaz Amalek. This establishes the birth of Amalek. We know that Esau was the twin brother of Jacob, and they were both grandsons of Abraham. With that in mind, let's turn back to Genesis 14, where I want to show you a potential contradiction in the Bible. And then I want to show you how it can be reconciled or explained. And you might want to keep this in mind kind of as an example if you ever get into a little discussion with a skeptic or an atheist or agnostic and they want to complain about how the Bible contradicts itself. I've not covered them all, of course, but I've never found a contradiction, supposed contradiction, that can't be reconciled and explained. There's hundreds of them, but every one of them can be explained. Well, this one in Genesis 14 contains the story of Abram, that was his name before it was changed to Abraham, rescuing his nephew Lot. We read in Genesis 14, verse 5, and in the 14th year came Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him and smote the Rephaims in Ashtaroth-Karnaim and the Zuzims in Ham and the Emims in Shaveh-Kiriathaim and the Horites in their Mount Seir unto El Paran, which is by the wilderness, and they returned and came to Emmishpat, which is Kadesh, and smote all the country of the Amalekites and all the Amorites that dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. The question is, since this incident is occurring long before the birth of Isaac, and therefore Jacob and Esau, and therefore Eliphaz, and therefore Amalek, how could there be a country of the Amalekites? Apparently we have an anachronism here. Is there a solution? Of course there is. There's a couple of possibilities. But like all the apparent contradictions in the Bible, when one does some digging or just put some effort into thinking about it, you will find that a solution appears or some kind of explanation logically presents itself. In this case, one simple explanation is that there could have been an earlier person named Amalek, of which we're told nothing else in the Bible except that there was a country of the Amalekites. And this later Amalek, whom we're concerned about in the story of Saul, was perhaps named for this earlier one. That's a possibility. We can't prove one way or another whether this earlier Amalek existed, so therefore it has to stand as a possible explanation. But perhaps more likely is the explanation that when Moses wrote the Pentateuch, he simply referred to this land area by the name by which it was known in his day. In other words, it wasn't called the country of the Amalekites back when Abraham was doing his thing rescuing Lot, but in order for his present-day readers at the time Moses wrote the Pentateuch during the 40 years in the wilderness, you know, that's when it was known as the country of the Amalekites. Anyhow, turn to Deuteronomy 25 and listen while I read a couple of other things about Amalek. We're going to read now about when the Israelites were coming out of Egypt, and I find this in Exodus 17, verse 8. It says, "Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim." And it goes on to tell the story of that battle. You remembered it's the one where Moses went up on top of the mountain, and as long as he kept his arms raised, the Israelites prevailed over the Amalekites. But whenever he got tired and started putting his arms down, then the Amalekites started winning the battle. And so Aaron and Hur got on either side of him and propped his arms up and held him up. Have you ever tried to hold your arms up for 5 minutes?
Yeah.
I mean, that gets torturous, doesn't it? Can you think, all day long, Moses held his arms up. Boy, you got to have good circulation, don't you? I think so. Well, anyhow, this incident concludes, if you're turning to Deuteronomy 25, stay there, but just one more verse, Exodus 17, 14. "And Yahweh said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." Now, the Israelites fought lots of different enemies over the centuries. What was it about Amalek that so angered God? Well, perhaps it's in the details that we find here in Deuteronomy 25, beginning in verse 17. "Remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when you were come forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God? So the Amalekites evidently used hit-and-run tactics, and they picked on the elderly and the feeble and so forth. That might be part of the reason, but I suspect that over the next several centuries, the Amalekites continued to be very cruel in their treatment of their enemies, in other words, Israel, and they were a very serious threat to the very existence of Israel. Now, I'm sure God had other reasons, of which the scriptures are silent, but in any event, God told Moses in verse 19 here, "Therefore it shall be, when Yahweh thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, in the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven, thou shalt not forget it." So here we are now 400 to 500 years later, after the Exodus from Egypt, and the time has come for the fulfillment of this particular prophecy. This is Saul's test. He is clearly commanded to totally exterminate them, man, woman, child, and animals. Would you not agree this is an ancient example of what today is called ethnic cleansing? All depends on what side of the fence you're on, right? Whether ethnic cleansing is good or bad.
Whether you're the cleansor or the cleansee.
Yeah. Let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 15. I forgot to mention to keep a marker there for the rest of the day. And verse 4. It says, "And Saul gathered the people together and numbered them in Telaim." And that word means lambs. 200,000 footmen and 10,000 men of Judah. I find this interesting. We've noticed it before in the story, I think it was in the story of Saul. Here it is in the reign of Saul. We don't know, but probably pretty early in the reign of Saul. And so he reigned 40 years, David reigned 40 years, and Solomon reigned 40 years. And after Solomon, what happened to the kingdom? It split into Israel and Judah. But here we are, perhaps as much as 110 years or more before the split, and yet it's given as Israel and Judah. 200,000 men and 10,000 men. Not only that, we can surmise there must have been some reluctance on the part of the Judahites to serve under King Saul. How do we know that? Well, they knew that the scepter was promised to their tribe, to the tribe of Judah. And that's perhaps why we see only 10,000 men coming from Judah. Let's do a little math. We discount the tribe of Levi because they were usually not called to serve, if I recall correctly. They were the chaplains. So they were not numbered in the army. So that leaves 200,000 men divided by 10 tribes. And that comes out to an average of 20,000 men per tribe volunteered to the army. And yet, also, we know that the larger tribes usually contributed more. Ephraim and Manasseh were very large tribes, but Judah was also one of the very largest tribes. So we would expect Judah should kick in maybe 30,000 men, and what'd they give? 10,000. So that is why we can surmise that there must have been some kind of animosity or reluctance on the part of the Judahites to go serve under Saul. You know, hey, who's this guy think he is? He's not even a Judahite, and the kingship was promised to us. Looking at the symbolism of the numbers, we drop the thousands just to deal with the essential numbers, so we find 200. Does anyone recall from our previous studies what 200 signifies? Exactly. Insufficiency. It's characteristic, as I mentioned earlier, of the Pentecostal realm. Pentecost is insufficient to bring us into the kingdom, the glorious kingdom age. Now if we add 10,000 of Judah, we get 210,000. Or drop the thousands, you've got 210, which is the number of years that the children of Israel spent in Egypt. Now, I know some of you might be thinking, oh, it was 430, according to Galatians 3:17, I think it is. But actually, the numbers don't work out with the 430, unless you go all the way back, and this is what it really means, when Abram first went down to Egypt, if you count 430 years from there, then it works out. But the actual time that the children of Israel were in Egypt, beginning with Jacob going down with his 70. That's 210 years, which is interesting because it's a multiple of 10 times 21. And Jacob personally had two times of 21 years in his life. One at the beginning when he went and served Laban for 21 years, it was the time of Jacob's trouble, 21 years. And then 21 years towards the end of his life when he thought Joseph was dead. Two times of 21 in his personal life. And then his family, when they become the nation of Israel, that's manifested on a corporate level in 10 times 21, or 210 years, Israel, time of Israel's or Jacob's trouble as a group in Israel, or in Egypt, excuse me. And now we find, well, the 210 or the 21 itself, the 21 itself is a number which means the exceeding sinfulness of sin, or the end of sin, because there were 21 sins mentioned that the children of Israel committed in the wilderness. But thank God the ark was moved 42 times, right? Two times 21, so that for every sin there's a double portion of grace to cover it, which is another reason why universal reconciliation is true. You cannot sin enough that grace doesn't cover it. Now, this is not an invitation to sin, of course, because the punishment stinks, especially that lake of fire deal. But this is just to say that not one of us, not even Adolf Hitler or Mao Zedong, can be nasty enough that God's grace can't cover it eventually. Not in this life for them, but eventually. So even though he could only get 10,000 troops from Judah, Saul now has an army of 210,000, which is a far cry from the 600 that he could get when he started. Remember a couple of messages back? He only had 600 men in the first battle against the Ammonites. So Saul has hit the big time. Big time nation now. And so he proceeds to ambush the Amalekites. Verse 5. And Saul came to a city of Amalek and laid wait in the valley. And Saul said unto the Kenites or Kenites, go, depart, get you down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them, for ye showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. We see a contrast here in that the Amalekites were cruel and violent towards Israel when they departed Egypt, whereas it says the Kenites showed kindness to Israel. And therefore, they are given a chance to depart before the Amalekites are slaughtered. Now, the Bible is silent as to just what kind of kindness it was that the Kenites rendered to the Israelites when they left Egypt, but I think we can make an educated guess as to the kindness it was after we look at a couple of scriptures first. The first mention of the Kenites is in Genesis 15. You won't need to turn there. I'll just read it to you. In the same day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abram. This is when he cut the animals in two and walked through the middle, and in a vision or a dream, really. Yahweh made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. Listen, number 19, the Kenites, that's the first mention, and the Kenizzites, and the Kadmonites, and the Hittites, and the Perizzites, and the Rephaims, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. So what this shows is that the Kenites had a land, and they lived somewhere between the Nile and the Euphrates, which not a whole lot of help, because almost all the Bible peoples live in that area. We do not know who the original man was who gave his name to the tribe. I'm just guessing maybe it was Ken. All right, feeble attempts at humor. But some writers in the seed line faction of those of us who understand the Israel message speculate that the Kenites were descendants of Cain. They make that claim based on the fact that the Hebrew lexicon states that the word translated Kenite is derived from the word translated Cain. Well, that may be so. But it is one thing to know that one name is based on another as a root word, but it does not necessarily follow logically that all Kenites are therefore physical descendants of Cain simply because of the etymology of their name. Those who make this claim are going to be stuck with a real dilemma in their theology as we look at the next passage. Turn to Judges chapter 1. And while you're turning there, a modern day example of this occurs to me. For example, you know, to say that all the Kenites were descended from Cain because of the etymology of the name is like saying that all of the black people in America who are descendants of slaves and took the name Washington or Lincoln or Jefferson, that they're all related to the white people that are Washington, Lincoln, or Jefferson, you know, or that they're descended from George Washington just because they have the name. Doesn't necessarily follow. No connection at all, possibly. Verse 16 of Judges 1. And we only need to read the first part of it. It says, "And the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law," in other words, Jethro, "went up out of the city of palm trees with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lieth south in the south of Arad. And they," the Kenites, "went and dwelt among the people," meaning the Kenites dwelt among the Israelites. So do you see their dilemma? I'm talking about those who make this claim that the Kenites were Canaanites. Because this identifies Jethro, or Reuel, if you will, as a Kenite. Now, we also know he was the priest of Midian. He was a Midianite, therefore he was a descendant of Abram through Keturah. But he evidently also had Kenite lineage. Now, most of us know about the situation with Moses' wife being called an Ethiopian in some translations of the scripture, and how modern Bible readers assume that that means that she was black. Which she was not, of course. We've addressed that elsewhere. But if Moses' wife, because she was the daughter of Jethro, if she was part Kenite through her father Jethro, then obviously Moses' children were part Kenite, right? And so if the Kenites are descended from Cain, then they have to deal with the fact that Moses' offspring are descendants of Cain. And that's a tough one for their theology, and since I don't follow that or hold to that, I'll let that hang there and let them deal with it. There's one more thing we could point out about the Kenite-Cain connection, and this we also do with our tongue firmly ensconced in our cheek. We would have you to know that the meaning of the word Kenite is Smith. Now, the Kenites lived not only among the Amalekites, because Saul's telling them to depart if you want to save your life. But since the time of Jethro and Moses, they were living amongst the Israelites. And lo and behold, look at all the Smiths living in America today. Yep, it's my cheek is full of tongue here. And so just look at all these descendants of Cain living among us today. Everybody with the name Smith, right? Means, I mean, this is, I'm doing this in trying to joke and just to make the point that to me that makes about as much sense as saying that the Kenites are descended from Cain. 1 Samuel 15:7. "And Saul smote the Amalekites from Havilah," that's way down south in Saudi Arabia on the coast towards Yemen, "until thou comest to Shur," that's way up there by the Sinai Peninsula, that is over against Egypt. "And he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword." Now, the word Agag there is not a proper name. Rather, it is a title. Like Pharaoh is the title of the king of Egypt, Agag is the title of the king of the Amalekites. Verse 9, "But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and of the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy," there's that phrase again, "utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, that they destroyed utterly. Then came the word of Yahweh unto Samuel, saying, It repenteth me that I have set up Saul to be king, for he is turning back from following me." And we're going to take up the idea of God supposedly repenting later in the message today. "And he hath not performed my commandments, and it grieved Samuel, and he cried unto Yahweh all night. And when Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, it was told Samuel, saying, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set him up a place, and is gone about, and passed on, and gone down to Gilgal. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said unto him, Blessed be thou of Yahweh, I have performed the commandment of Yahweh. And Samuel said, What meaneth then this bleating of the sheep in mine ears, and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul said, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice unto Yahweh thy God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed. Let's back up and analyze this. After the slaughter of the Amalekites, it says Saul went to Carmel and set him up a place. Now this was not the Mount Carmel up on the northern coast where Elijah had the showdown with the priests of Baal a couple hundred years later. This was another Carmel, which was a place in the mountains of Judah southeast of Hebron, which was on Saul's way home from the southlands of Judah as he came up then and stopped at that Carmel and set up a place. We'll get to that in a minute. Then went up to the land of Benjamin where his home territory was, and then went down to Gilgal. Now Samuel lives about 15 miles away from Gilgal in Ramah, and he comes over to pay Saul a visit. Now if he walked, it would be an all-day hike and then some at a very brisk pace. Have you ever, I went on a hike one time and it was 8 miles, and that was all I wanted to do in a day. So what I'm saying is, Samuel could have left early in the morning, and if he was moving at a pretty rapid clip, maybe got there late in the evening. And so Saul sees him arriving and he greets him, paraphrased, "Samuel, old buddy, old pal, praise the Lord, I have performed the commandment of Yahweh." Well, who does Saul think he's fooling? Up until this point, Saul's chief fault seemed to have been his rashness and his self-will. Now he's adding impudence and pride and deceitfulness and hypocrisy. And when someone is a liar and a deceiver, they are often blind to just how transparent their lies are to everybody but themselves. Have you noticed that? I mean, the proof is right there in front of him and Samuel. The proof is there on hoof, bellowing and bleating. It's what's known in the criminal trade as a bald-faced lie. So Samuel confronts the Pentecostal king head-on in verse 14. "Well, Saul, you know, if you perform the commandments of Yahweh, then how come I hear these sheep bleating and the oxen bellowing? Did you pick them up at a blue light special at Kmart in downtown Gilgal?" The fact that the sheep and the oxen are still alive and have not yet been sacrificed is evidence of Saul's great pride being manifested. How's that, you ask? Well, look at verse 12. It says that Saul set him up a place. Now, unfortunately, the King James Version obscures the meaning here, and the Farrar Fenton is not very good there either. It's totally wrong. The word place literally is, it's the Hebrew word yad, which means a hand. Now, in the old days, in Saul's day, when they set up a hand, it was often the way they set up a monument to themselves. And even today, you know, you got great figures, war heroes and stuff. They raise their hand, a Statue of Liberty, right? The hand. To raise the hand was a euphemism or a figure of speech to put up a monument to oneself. So what did Saul do first? He put up a monument to proclaim his great victory. And then he brought the sheep and the oxen and is telling Samuel now that he's going to sacrifice them. What pride. Where are Saul's priorities at this time? Well, it's me first and God second, right? I trust the application of this lesson is obvious in our personal lives. So let's each of us examine ourselves in that. In verse 15, now when Samuel challenges him about where he got the animals, did you pick them up at Kmart? Saul says, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen. There he goes again, blame shifting. Saul wants to blame it all on the people. But verse 9 gives the lie to that, because it wasn't just the people, because it says Saul and the people spared Agag and the animals. So whether the king decreed it and the people went along with it, or some of the people suggested it and the king said okay and he approved it, it doesn't matter. They are both guilty and responsible. But now Saul is trying to weasel out of responsibility for the decision. Just as an aside, have you noticed how sophisticated this matter of accepting blame or responsibility has become in modern American politics. Take the Waco Inferno, for example. When the people get incensed enough over an issue, and the public outcry is so great that the politicians and bureaucrats realize that someone has to take the blame, here's the way they do it. You'll have Louis Freeh, former director of the FBI, or Janet Reno come forward and solemnly recount what a great tragedy it was, and then they, with feigned humility, will say something like, "I accept full responsibility for this tragic event." And the dominant media will then report that Janet Reno has taken responsibility for Waco. End of story. It's PR, folks. It's the dark side of public relations. And I say the dark side because I used to be in PR, and I know there's a good side. All we usually hear is the bad side, though. But it's all image and no substance. You just say you're taking responsibility, and the media confirms to the people that you've taken responsibility, and that's the end of it. Can somebody tell me what's missing here? What's wrong with that? Yes. Exactly. You remember serial murderer Ted Bundy? We could think of a number of examples here, but he's one that comes to mind. He was executed, what, 10 years ago, maybe? Well, it would be like after Ted Bundy is caught and all the evidence points to his being guilty of, say, 30 murders. And so Ted Bundy calls a press conference and says, "Now, these were some very tragic events. They were very gruesome murders, and they're really inexcusable. But it was due to a lot of mix-ups here and there, and things kind of got out of hand in my childhood this and my childhood that. And it's just a real tragedy. I just want the nation to know that I accept full responsibilities for these murders.
And I'm sorry."
End of statement. And so the media, yeah, and I'm sorry. And so the media reports that Ted Bundy has taken full responsibility for the murders. And so Ted Bundy goes home. End of story.
Job application.
What's the difference between that and Janet Reno? If someone is to take responsibility for something, it means they must suffer the consequences for their actions.
Make restitution,
right. And that's why it's capital punishment when it comes to murder and kidnapping. You can't make restitution. And King Saul is about to hear just that from the lips of Samuel. We're in verse 15. "For the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice unto Yahweh thy God." I wonder if this is a subliminal slip here where Saul refers to Yahweh as thy God. Yeah. Did Saul subconsciously realize that Yahweh was no longer his God? That may or may not be a subliminal slip, but there's another possibility which we're going to look at shortly. Meanwhile, Saul has first tried to shift the blame to the people. Secondly, I think in this scenario here, Saul is probably ad-libbing. He's making up his excuses on the spot. Saul is very quick in verbal sparring, dueling with words. Even though he knows God has commanded utter destruction, Saul is basically saying that he knows better than God. Right? God said to destroy him. Saul says, "Well, I think we'll sacrifice him." Which is a very lame excuse on the face of it, because if God commanded that everything and everybody be utterly destroyed, then certainly Saul knows that God's not going to be pleased with a sacrifice of those things. Verse 16. "Then Samuel said unto Saul, Stay." I don't think Saul was planning to go anywhere. Actually, it would be better translated as "be quiet," or in the common vernacular, "shut up." So Samuel tells him, "Shut up, and I will tell thee what Yahweh hath said to me this night." And he said unto him, "Say on." And Samuel said, "When thou wast little in thine own sight," in other words, Saul, when you were once a humble man, "were you not made head of the tribes of Israel, and Yahweh anointed thee king over Israel? And Yahweh sent thee on a journey and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed. Wherefore then didst thou not obey the voice of Yahweh, but didst fly upon the spoil, and didst evil in the sight of Yahweh?" Well, several times since the beginning of this story, we've seen this little phrase, "utterly destroy," as used in verse 18 here. It has a special meaning in these instances because it's the Hebrew word karam, which has a number of meanings, but it has to do with certain things being, quote, devoted to or consecrated to God, i.e., consecrated to destruction. They're to be completely destroyed. Now, that sounds like a funny concept. If it's devoted to God, how come it's destroyed? Well, that's just what it was. It's the same word, the same thing that happened when God told Joshua and the Israel people or the armies to do it to Jericho. Utterly destroy every man, woman, and child. It's the same word, karam. Jericho was devoted to God. All the silver, all the gold, everything in it was to be destroyed. The silver, gold, etc., were to be brought into God's treasury. But nobody was to take any of the spoils, were they? But there was one guy that did. Remember that? We did a story on that many years ago. We called it Achan's Heart Problems. And by the time it was all over, it was in. As far as Achan was concerned, it was a real heartache because it was the biggest case of heartburn anybody's ever heard. You know, remember what happened? Achan took full responsibility, didn't he? And Joshua saw to it that he did. He and his family, they were all executed and then burned. You talk about heartburn. Sir Bert.
When they talk about destroyed, by the way, according to the studies I've had, it implied specifically burning. So that's why it was applied to being devoted to God, because anything burned was considered to be specifically offered to God in ultimate judgment or acceptance. Either way,
yeah.
It mattered to them. They were basically saying, it's out of our hands and it's in His. You're being burned and you're being caught up and you're going to face...
Utterly consumed.
So consumed is always specifically with the burn context. Which
right.
By the late fire force, I do that too. But anyway, as far as the... devoted to God, it's not devoted necessarily good or bad according to our ability to understand. It simply means they're saying we can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
You have to go to Him. So the way you go to Him is you burn. That's why Achan was burned too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Kind of like Waco, huh?
Kind of like Waco. Out of our hands, you're going to go to God.
And the point is, can you see that what Saul did was exactly what Achan did?
Yeah.
Exactly. All the Amalekites and their possessions were devoted to God. They were under the ban, B-A-N, under the ban of total destruction. At least when Achan was caught, he didn't try to weasel out of it. He fessed up. That was the end of it. He took full responsibility, and he was consumed by fire. But Saul is fortunate in that he is not immediately executed. His execution is deferred for many years until God brings the Philistines to ultimately do it. But by the time of this present incident, which we're studying, and I believe it's still quite early in his reign, we see Saul's character is now marked by a multitude of flaws. And remember, Saul is characteristic of the church under Pentecost. And this is what we can see on a corporate level, as we talked about last time, all the last 2,000 years, and on individual personal levels. But Saul's character is now marked by pride, rashness, basic dishonesty and deceitfulness and lying, blame shifting, unfaithfulness, in other words, he wasn't faithful to God in carrying out the duty, unreliability, disrespect, and on, and it only goes downhill from here.